Welcome back, everybody, to the Heartland Politics Podcast, where we explore politics, economics, and culture here in the Midwestern Heartland. This show is aired and distributed by WVIK Public Radio, NPR, in the Quad Cities, and I'm your host, Robin Johnson. Our guest today is a distinguished journalist, historian, and author who has written several books about the idea of nationhood and regional cultures in the United States, including, and I've got to give a plug for this, American Nations. This is a great book on the idea of regional cultures, and I use this in one of the classes I teach at Monmouth College for many years. I have to say, the book is somewhat controversial in that it basically says that we need to stop thinking about regions so much and think about nations, and it convinced usually about half the students in my class to think differently about it. I strongly recommend that book. Colin Woodard, and his latest book I recommend also. It just came out. It's a very timely topic, as you'll hear here soon. The book's called Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood, and I'm very grateful he's taken some time out to talk about this book. Colin, thank you so much.
Hey, it's a pleasure to join you again.
You know, right off the bat, and I'm sure I know how you came to write this book, but you talk about the myth of national unity, purpose, and identity, and how the myth continues to affect us today. That's pretty sensitive stuff there compared to how people usually think about this, but that's why I like this book. It's very provocative. Talk a little bit about that myth, and then go into the meat of the book as far as it's got five protagonists. Our listeners have heard probably of a couple of them. A couple of them haven't, but they're very important on how the idea of nationhood took course in our country.
Yeah, well, the previous book that you spoke of, American Nations, showed that we've never really been one America, but several Americas, and that they were really a balkanized federation, comprising a bunch of sort of countries in waiting with very different fundamental ideas about how society should be organized and the like. And that the differences between these regional cultures, or as I put them, these nations, these stateless nations, tie back to the distinction between the different European colonial projects that formed on the eastern and southwestern rims of what's now the United States. And each of these cultures, the Puritan-founded New England colonies, the Dutch-settled area around New York City, the Scots-Irish, backcountry and uplands extending on into in one branch of it grafting down the Ohio River to settle the lower tiers of states like Ohio and Indiana and Illinois, the Deep South founded by English slave lords from Barbados, and so on, that each of these separate colonial projects was founded at a different time by people with distinct and often adversarial ethnological and religious and political characteristics with different original intents, different ideas about the fundamental questions, about freedom. Is it ultimately about individual liberty or about building a free community? Because those two things have opposing policy implications, about the relationship between church and state, and so on. So, the fact that they ended up together was sort of an accident of history. In the colonial period, they were rivals and often enemies, being on the opposite sides of various colonial wars and, events that occurred even within the British Empire and among the British colonies, like the Allegiance and English Civil War of the 1640s. So they ended up together because of a shared threat of the change in British colonial policy in the 1770s, which sought to remove the idiosyncrasies and differences in self-government and autonomy of these colonies and make them, more obedient and conforming to the desires of the crown. And that led, of course, to a war in which they all allied against this threat, and lo and behold, they won. But in winning, they found themselves sort of accidentally in this thing called the United States that had started as a joint military command in the form of the Continental Army, and they had a joint treaty organization, the Continental Congress, that had fled from location to location during the war as the front shifted. But now they were part of this United States. And no one was sure what that was supposed to be, even after a constitution was written, even after the second and current constitution was written. The notion of whether this was ultimately supposed to be something that would resemble today's European Union, a bunch of sovereign states that have given giving up their powers over certain matters like foreign trade and defense to a central organization, or whether it was supposed to be a confederation where anyone could leave at any time, like the Germans had at that time in Central Europe, or was it supposed to become a real, you know, unified nation state like Prussia had or Japan had built or post-revolutionary France? Nobody knew. And so up until this, you know, into the early 19th century, this was starting to become more and more problematic as the shared struggle of the American Revolution passed from living memory, as the generation who fought the revolution and could look to the united victory as inspiration to hold a United States together. As that faded and various secession movements had formed, like during the War of 1812, the New England colonies had considered seceding. So by the 1820s and 1830s, as the fact that slavery was not just going to wither away on its own, as some had assumed in the revolutionary generation, that in fact it was here to stay with all of the implications that had for, you know, a federation supposedly founded around the proposition that all humans are created equal, all of those things meant that there needed to be an answer as to why the United States existed, what its story was as a nation. If it was going to be a unified country, how could they explain all these differences? Because there was no, you know, unlike other countries in Europe and elsewhere who were creating these national stories, right? A story that individuals could believe enough to feel a sense of belonging and kinship with other people within this abstract entity, be it Germany or Japan or Belgium or whatever country you're in, to have that allegiance that you might be willing to give your life over to, that you have more allegiance to these people in this abstract thing called a nation than to other people next door who aren't in that nation, you know, Germans to Austrians and so on. That requires a really good and convincing story. And so the United States suddenly needed one, and yet it lacked a shared history, shared ethnography, shared religious background, a unique language different from the empire it had just rebelled from. It didn't have a mythic story that they could feel that, you know, people had lived here since time immemorial, like, you know, somebody in, you know, an older, you know, European or Japanese or Japan or somewhere else might think, because everyone knew that just a couple centuries before the European colonizers came and take it from other people. So in other words, it had none of the easy ingredients to build the national story. And so Union is the story of how that was successfully created and the fight over what that story would be, the story of American purpose and who we are as a people, where we came from and where we're supposed to be going.
I thought it was interesting that you pointed out that if you were to ask people in the early days of the United States where they were from, they were more likely to say they were from a state, South Carolina or Pennsylvania or someplace, rather than an American.
Absolutely. You know, what country you were from all the way up into the early 19th century, that's how people would answer. I'm a Massachusettsian. I'm a South Carolinian. When people were trying to write histories, and history is kind of a sketch of who you are as a people, people weren't writing a history of the United States. They were writing a history of New Hampshire and a history of Connecticut and a history of Virginia, because everyone knew that they didn't have a shared past before the 1770s. And so it was very problematic to try to conceive of the United States is anything more than maybe a treaty organization or a legal, you know, construct to serve the interests of the component states, which obviously led to great problems once you got to the 1850s and we're rolling towards the Civil War. So yes, the creation of an American identity that people could embrace, and indeed, you know, it happened. And my interest was knowing the backstory from American nations is how did it happen? And when, and for what reason, and by whom was it created? Because that tells you a lot about the legacy of that story, which is all important for any country. And, you know, at a time when the United States, people are starting to ask those same questions in a time of crisis. What holds us together? You know, with these enormous regional variations in political support for one party or another, or for Trumpism or not, or different policy, you know, preferences and constitutional preferences. How do you keep all of that together in one country? That's unfortunately becoming a very relevant question again.
The by whom is what we'll focus on next. The different narratives, as you just mentioned, told by whom. As I mentioned earlier, I mean, some of these folks, you focus on five people. Most folks will, well, most everybody will recognize two. Some of us will recognize another. But two of the earlier people were more obscure historical figures, but had a major role, as I learned in reading this book.
Huge, yeah. And I wanted to tell it through the people. I mean, it reads, it's constructed a bit like a novel in that mm-hmm. you have separate characters, almost like a biography, and each of them are in parallel storylines that collide. And I did that not only because it makes for much more interesting reading than doing as a straight history, but more importantly, it tells and asks the right questions. You know, the people who came up with ideas, and ideas are among the most powerful things in human civilization, but they're abstractions, and they start as an idea in somebody's head. How do they, you know, the experiences of that person, who they were raised by, the culture they came from within, you know, what their childhood was like, who their friends were and their enemies and their formative experiences shape a lot about their ideas about the world and how it ought to be. And to do that and to also show how an idea can come from something in somebody's head that they write down to something in the, you know, the zeitgeist, the shared unconsciousness of a people, that dissemination of ideas is best told through the actual, you know, week-to-week events and drama of their lives as they try to promote and fight with others over what, you know, what that idea should be, what the national story should be. And so it started, indeed, with two figures who are largely forgotten today but were towering figures in the early 19th century. The first draft of our story came from a man named George Bancroft, who in brief was, you know, sort of the most eminent American historian of the 19th century, and he lived through most of the century. He was born in 1800 and didn't die until the 1890s and was actively writing through much of that period. He was, a New Englander through and through, son of a Congregational minister, went to Phillips Exeter, went to Harvard and graduated at 17 years old in 1817. And he was taken by the president of Harvard as a promising student. He was bookish and nearsighted and, you know, academic and sort of tightly buttoned up sort of person. And President Kirkland of Harvard sent him to get a rare thing, a doctoral degree, at a time when there were no PhD programs in the United States or indeed almost anywhere in the world. You could get them in Germany at these new universities that were using rational thinking and evidence-based inquiry to build what we would recognize today as modern, you know, research institutions. And Bancroft, as a young man, was sent to study there and studied literally under the intellectual figures in Europe who kind of invented European nationalism, you know, Hegel and Herring and the Van Humboldts and these other towering figures of romantic nationalism were his professors. And they gave him letters of introduction where he traveled around Europe and, you know, hung out and had dinner parties with the Marquis de Lafayette in Paris, you know, wandering the countryside with the novelist Washington Irving, runs into, Lord Byron in Italy on the deck of the USS Constitution, which was making a port visit there, and ends up, you know, hanging out in his villa, dancing with princesses. In other words, he became, as a young man, welcomed into this sort of 19th century world of letters, and also was asked as this exotic American, because Europeans saw America as one place, even if Americans didn't, about his country, and was immersed at a time in Germany when Germans and other people in Europe were trying to create nation states. You know, Germany was a scattering of hundreds of principalities and duchies in a loose confederation, and still considering whether you could create a Germany. So all these questions were before him, and that prompted young Bancroft to think about his own country and whether or not, you know, what would make it a nation. And eventually, when he came home, he decided to write a draft of what that was, inspired both by his New England background, this Puritan idea that, you know, the early Puritans were tasked by God, like the Old Testament Hebrews, to do certain things in the earth and collectively had to build a new society. He took that and fused it with various German ideas to create the first draft of our civic national story, many elements of which you'll recognize today. And that story set forth in a 10-volume history of the United States that he wrote that took him overall 70 years to write, with each volume coming out like, you know, like the Harry Potter novels, this massive cultural experience that everyone embraced and talked about that reshaped the way people talked about America and its history. And that went roughly that we don't have a shared past that is clear, But what we have is a shared commitment, a fealty to the ideals in the Declaration of Independence, that if you share this commitment to the ideas that all humans are, you know, created equal, and that they have these inalienable rights to life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, representative self-government, that's what holds Americans together. And that more than that, and this is the Puritan part coming through, that God has cast Americans for this purpose, that what holds all the disparate colonies together, they may appear to be different, but that God literally placed the seed of each of America in each of these colonies, and they grew together with an inevitable destiny towards the 1770s, when they would all fulfill their chosen purpose passed down by the Creator to carry human freedom forward and across the continent. So all these ideas of American exceptionalism, of manifest destiny and all that, were encoded in his histories. And Americans were ready to receive those ideas. They needed answers. But in doing that, he also provoked very promptly a counter-reaction from the Deep South with a totally different narrative that had equally strong sway over Americans over time.
Yeah, the interesting thing is I read this, and I'll kind of lead you right into that second person is in narrative, was that the Southerners, ironically, wanted to kind of ignore the Declaration, which was written by a fellow Southerner, Southerner, Thomas Jefferson, and focused more on the Constitution.
A great irony, right? Coming in the form of William Gilmore Sims in my narrative. Sims is, like Bancroft, forgotten today, but he was perhaps the most successful American novelist, you know, of the early 19th century. He was the leading man of letters of the antebellum South and the Confederacy. He wrote histories, he ran literary journals, he dabbled in politics, but he was a towering figure at the time, and he put forth basically a reaction to this civic national definition of the United States that Bancroft and his allies had embraced. And his was steeped in his native South Carolina. He was from Charleston. He eventually rose to be a plantation owner and a slave owner, and articulating a counter narrative that would eventually take the form of the Confederate States of America. And that was that Thomas Jefferson was completely wrong, that humans obviously aren't created equal, they're created unequally, and that only certain people have the genius to embrace the promise of American democracy and to be capable of self-government, and that those people are the allegedly superior Anglo-Saxon race, that it's Anglo-Saxon brilliance and cultural heritage that has allowed America to be what it is, and what ties these separate sovereign states of America together is their shared superior Anglo-Saxon, you know, legacy. And, you know, he didn't know of genetics yet, but that was kind of what he was talking about. Mm-hmm. So it was an ethno-state definition that not all people living in the United States are entitled to the American promise, but only a subset of them deemed to be worthy. In other words, if all humans are created equal, his argument was that only certain people are fully human, and certainly not African Americans in his definition, but also all sorts of other people. And so that legacy, that sort of white supremacist model is what it would morph into over time, was put forth as early as the civic national narrative. Within a few years, it was out there too. And there was a fight over who was right, you know, a fight that obviously took the role of the Civil War, but would ultimately, this ethno-national vision was not vanquished during the Civil War, and would in fact, you know, rise to become the dominant narrative in the United States at the turn of the 19th and 20th centuries.
So you had these two ideas, narratives of Bancroft and Sims. And just to be clear, Bancroft wasn't a more modern, what you would call by modern terms, progressive vision. He actually supported Stephen Douglas over Lincoln. He met Lincoln, and you talk about that in the book. But then here comes a third strain by a more noted figure that our listeners will recognize.
Yeah, so the pivotal figure in the middle of it, a man just a little bit younger than Sims and Bancroft, was Frederick Douglass, who was, you know, for those who don't know, you know, a fugitive slave. He'd been born into slavery in the eastern shore of Maryland and eventually escaped in a daring escape by a new technology. It's kind of like escaping from slavery in the SpaceX rocket today. He boarded one of the first scheduled passenger train services between Baltimore, where he was living, and Philadelphia. And he did it in disguise. It was a harrowing escape. He made it to New York City, got into the Underground Railway. They sent him off to the relative safety of New Bedford, Massachusetts, where he was working as a day laborer when he was discovered by the abolitionists, the people fighting slavery, the William Garrison's, you know, crew. And they had been speaking out against slavery and its ills, and they discovered this, you know, fugitive slave living among them who had secretly taught himself to read and write and to speak, and in fact turned out to not only have an incredible first-hand story to tell about the horrors of slavery and what they do to both the enslaved and the enslavers alike, but could tell it incredibly well. He had these amazing oratorical gifts, and it turned out he was an incredible writer. And they whisked him up, put him on their speaking circuit to be their star, and he was a star. They sent him all over on the railway lines, all over the northern part of the country, you know, out into the Midwest, you know, into, you know, at a time when it was still the frontier. He eventually outgrew them, was more militant than they were politically. He eventually had to flee to avoid being recaptured during the 1850s to the United Kingdom, where he became a superstar there, traveling through Ireland, Scotland, and England, speaking to enormous audiences. He became an international celebrity. And what he spoke about and wrote about very effectively through his long life, he also lived into the end of the 19th century, through the Civil War years, through the horrors of Reconstruction and its failure, you know, with the Ku Klux Klan, you know, doing a reign of terror to reverse the political emancipation of African Americans in the former Confederacy. He saw that and lived through it. What he said throughout his time was he took that civic national vision that had been packaged by Bancroft, that the country was about those ideals in the Declaration of Independence. And he said, you know, these are great ideals, Americans, and you haven't lived up to them, that you're still aspiring towards them. And look, you know, in his own life, he could tell about the hypocrisies and shortcomings and how we hadn't achieved those ideals, and was imploring and, you know, maybe having misplaced faith in white Northerners to do the right thing and stand up for these things. And in doing so, he articulated America's, you know, civic national narrative better than anyone else has in his speeches, including Bancroft, because of the tragedy and tension in it all. He would influence and meet with Abraham Lincoln, and as would Bancroft, in shaping and pushing him towards the, you know, the Gettysburg Address, which was the moment when Lincoln basically said the Civil War is about civic nationalism over ethno-nationalism, about the ideals of the Declaration. Now, that was all pushed by other figures. So Douglass was a towering and pivotal figure in our national story and in the middle of the narrative of union.
The book, you then kind of trace the history of Reconstruction, the passage of the constitutional amendments 13, 14, 15, and then the corrupt election of 1876, and then you pick up on a former president who, as we were talking a little before the interview, just it's almost shocking, I would say, to discover some of the things that he believed. But so much here, I think, is worth, again, sharing now in these times, because it's so relevant to what we're going through. But this person kind of brought back a version of the Sims narrative of the United States.
Yeah, if it was said that the South lost the war, the Civil War, but won the peace, the crowning moment for that victory was the election of Woodrow Wilson to the White House. Because he was the first Deep Southern ever elected to the presidency, but certainly since the Civil War. He'd been raised in Augusta, Georgia during the conflict. His father, who he looked up to and was the most important formative figure in his life, was the leading light of the Confederate Church, the Presbyterian Church, and had made his fame through his arguments that God endorsed slavery and that was, you know, holy and consistent with the Bible, which was a very popular position to hold in the South. They then lived in Columbia, South Carolina during the Reconstruction period, when, you know, after it had been burned by Sherman, and when South Carolina was the state that had the, you know, the largest an African-American supermajority. So during the Union occupation and the Reconstruction period, when African-Americans could in fact vote and stand for office,
it was a place where African Americans actually had a majority and can control the legislature. And so this was the most outrageous situation for white supremacists. And Woodrow Wilson was living right in the cockpit of the battle, you know, in a house just a few blocks from the South Carolina legislature. And he had deeply white supremacist views his entire life. They're encoded. They're written right out there, plain to read, in all of his academic works he did and the histories that he wrote, including his popular History of the American People. And they, unfortunately, when he is elevated to the presidency, they're immediately, central to his policies. You know, Woodrow Wilson is the guy who came and segregated the federal government, segregated the post offices and the like. The first blockbuster film that was created, the first Hollywood film, The Birth of a Nation, which was created by D.W. Griffith and co-produced by Thomas Dixon Jr. based on a novel glorifying the Ku Klux Klan and its reign of terror to end the political emancipation of African Americans in the South in general and in South Carolina particularly. And this blockbuster film had a budget like nobody had ever seen, extras, technical accomplishments. It was a milestone in film history, but was also, you know, a total repudiation of civic nationalism and of the American, commitment to, you know, human equality and all the rest. It said that the Klan was right, that African Americans are incapable of self-government, and that it was all great that there was this deadly reign of terror against them. So, as you might imagine, that was a controversial take to have, even in 1915 when the movie came out. And there were enormous protests in all the major cities against the film. Sort of an early Black Lives Matter kind of movement, you might say, led often by, you know, the first big demonstrations led by, African-American civil rights leaders occurred in places like Boston. And there was a possibility that they would succeed in crushing the film because in 1915, the courts had not yet ruled that artistic productions were protected speech under the First Amendment. And so mayors and governors regularly censored plays and now films that were considered, you know, inconsistent with public morals. And that's what the protesters in New York and Boston and other big cities wanted done about The Birth of a Nation. And so mayors were under pressure to do exactly that. And if that had happened, you know, the amount of debt that D.W. Griffith and Thomas Dixon Jr. had taken on to make this film was staggering. It was like a quadrillion-dollar film in production at the time. And if denied the major film markets of the country, they were worried that they would be bankrupted. And so they did a Hail Mary pass. And that was this. Thomas Dixon Jr. went to his buddy and former graduate school classmate at Johns Hopkins, President Woodrow Wilson, and asked him to do them a favor, and Wilson did it. He screened the film in the middle of this controversy in the White House for his entire cabinet. And Thomas Dixon Jr., the next morning, on the strength of that, went across town to the home of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Chief Justice White of Louisiana, and asked him if he would show the film to the other justices. And when White found out what the film was about, he said absolutely, because he had been in the KKK and thought the movie scenes were wonderful. He rented the biggest and most prestigious ballroom in Washington, D.C., and showed it not only to his fellow justices, but to the leaders of Congress. And that pretty basically knocked the wind out of the sails of anyone trying to argue that you should censor this film for public morals when it was receiving the de facto endorsement of the President of the United States, his cabinet, and all the leadership in Washington. So that intervention alone gives you a sense of just how involved Woodrow Wilson was in these issues, and also that how the white supremacist vision triumphed in the 1910s and 1920s, which is when many of these Confederate statues we're seeing toppled now were first put up, when the formations of the 1924 Immigration Act, which was based on racial quotas to explicitly maintain the Anglo-Saxon character of the United States. You know, this was a time when that other model, that uglier and non-inclusive model for the United States, was ascendant, and, you know, ascendant not only in the South, but in the North as well. And it was the first moment of consensus across regions as to what the United States was, one that dispensed with the promise in the Gettysburg Address and in the Declaration in favor of a shared North and South reconciliation based on white. reputation as a, you know, naive idealist.
The final narrative is a person that some of us had heard of anyway, but it concerns the frontier, and where, of course, here in the Midwest, we were the frontier at one point. In some ways, we perhaps still are. But I think I thought this was interesting in the qualities, the procrastination of this individual who never got some of his best work done. It kind of reminded me of me. And how he came, kind of began questioning his theory later in life.
Yeah, and that person was Frederick Jackson Turner, who was, you know, one of the most famous historians of the late 19th and early 20th century, whose legacy and shadow is very long and continues to influence our culture today. And he was indeed a Midwesterner. Unlike all these other people who were from the Eastern Seaboard, he was born in Port Dodge, Wisconsin, and he was, at a time when Western Wisconsin was the frontier, and he grew up in the Midwest and in the West, and as you might imagine, saw the story of America differently. His argument was it was the West that made America what it is, and that when the settlers from these different regions of the country, from the greater New England space, you know, the tier of upstate New York and the Western Reserve of Ohio and Michigan and stuff that had been primarily and initially settled by New Englanders and their descendants, or the Scots-Irish Greater Appalachian Zone that I described before that includes the lower tiers of like Indiana and Ohio and Illinois and on into large parts of Missouri and so on, that these different groups, when they crossed the Appalachian Mountains into the West, he believed that they all sort of became one and became a different and distinct people, an American people. Because unlike the Eastern Seaboard, he believed the West was sort of an open Eden. He kind of he regarded the Native Americans as sort of just a scenery in his narrative, that they weren't a significant part of the story, and they just sort of fall and disappear away as the settlers, the real stars of his story, come across the mountains. And are finally far from the old world, you know, legacy, the taint of feudalism and everything else that Turner saw in East Coast society, that they had to rebuild again in the frontier conditions, and that, you know, he was drawing on basically a Bancroftian civic national vision, right, that America was about, you know, these ideals about freedom and the inherent, you know, quality of people. But he swapped out God being involved for what, at the time he was writing, in the late 19th and early 20th century, was the sexiest new scientific theory, the implications of Darwin's thesis, especially about environmental selection. You know, Darwin, when he, you know, reached the Galapagos Islands, noted famously that all these different finches had adapted into subspecies based on the local conditions and particularities of the environment of each of these different islands. And Turner believed that American settlers coming from all these different zones of the country were all shaped by the same facts of frontier life in the Midwest, and that all shaped them into a common people with American characteristics, being civically involved and self-starters and, you know, committed to your neighbors and to self-government. All those American qualities happened when Americans reached the West. And that frontier thesis, as it was called, was embraced immediately by Americans who thought it was the greatest thing ever and, you know, swept into curricula of the new public high schools that were being started in the same era everywhere, in college curricula, in political speeches, and then in movies, as movies started happening, you know, with an effect all the way through to the, you know, cowboy and Indian movies and the ideas about, you know, Daniel Boone and John Wayne and all that stuff. All drew from the frontier thesis. But the irony you mentioned is that, ironically, almost as soon as he presented this thesis at the Chicago World's Fair in 1893, he realized that the data wasn't supporting it. He dug deeper in order to try to write a book about this and discovered that no matter what he looked at, over time, the separate settlement streams that I describe in American Nations, the people from the separate settlement streams weren't becoming more alike over time. They weren't assimilating. They were keeping their differences, political or otherwise, you know, all the cultural things he looked at. He got more and more frustrated trying to figure out what the secret was. Was there a difference in soil types or something that would explain the difference in behavior? Because he believed it had to be the natural environment, not culture, that was the most determinative factor. And he was working towards that for most of his life. His magnum opus was going to be about America and its sections, a book that might have resembled American Nations had he ever finished it. But as you mentioned, he loved research. He loved teaching in his students. He hated writing. He procrastinated. He would fill, you know, entire rooms, you know, like the last scene of Raiders of the Lost Ark. He'd fill warehouses with notes for books that he would never get around to finishing, including this magnum opus that was not completed when he died. But that was the carrying forward of that civic national tradition into this peculiar frontier cul-de-sac that nonetheless had a big influence on the way Americans think of themselves.
We're way over on our time, but that's okay. I kind of figured that would happen because there's so much here that's just so interesting to me. I will tell our listeners that Rock Island is mentioned in this book, but I'm not going to say any more. You got to go buy it. It's a small mention, but you got to go buy it to find out. And again, I recommend this book and American Nations both. I guess to try to bring this all together with what's going on now in our country, it seems like through settlement patterns and then now sorting, which is the name for it, where we're all living closer to people who have similar cultures, viewpoints, it manifests itself politically. You have secession movements in states. Illinois, there's a secession movement in southern Illinois. I thought it was interesting, you point out that William Lloyd Garrison even talked about secession of some of the northern free states, which I wasn't aware of. This seems to be ongoing, and it leads back to, again, how can we have a shared narrative about the United States and stay together when our interpretations of certain key fundamental values of our country, like freedom, are subject to disagreement? And that's been going on from the beginning.
Yeah, that's been the Achilles heel for the United States the whole time. And yet, you know, there have been time periods where we have achieved some sort of governing unity. And when that's happened, and a book in between American Nations and Union called American Character gets into this, but the times when we've had a stable regional-based governing coalitions, and there have been decades where that's been the case, and have been able to move forward and do big things in one direction or another, have been times when one or another of the two, you know, regional superpower blocks has been able to gain a supermajority. And, you know, in the House of Representatives and the Senate and in the Electoral College to govern the country. And those weren't based on party. Those used to be, you know, cross-partisan because the parties weren't ideologically and geographically sorted the way they are now. But, you know, there would be the Deep South and its rotating coalition partners versus Yankeedom and its rotating coalition partners. And there would be swing regions, including the Midlands, which stretches over much of your listening area, that, you know, were unconvinced by either grouping, but would switch back and forth. And so, you know, in effect, the only way as a federation we can move forward is to have a consensus about who we're supposed to be that may not convince every regional culture, but is convincing enough to a super majority of them to make it possible to govern the country and move forward. And that has to draw on this civic national tradition, because the only alternative we have that has, you know, the kind of background and depth in our history to be credible is this ethno-national one. And even if you were to dispense with the profound immorality of the ethno-national view, it's impossible for that to govern. That's only a recipe for dissolution and civil war, because unlike the 1910s, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants and white Americans are no longer a supermajority electoral force that can, you know, govern that way. You can't win free and fair elections based on that. And as the demographic trends continue, it will become less and less possible to do that even at smaller scales. So it's the civic national tradition that's going to, you know, save the federation and the country overall, and that's the understanding it and adapting it for the 21st century are among the many challenges facing the country in the next few years as we try to rebuild from our current state of crisis.
One last point that I think is critical too in a summer, in a time of Black Lives Matters. Everybody saw the George Floyd killing and the urban unrest and what's been going on, and now the controversy over statues and the names of schools. This book is a very timely for those topics as well. for folks who are interested in how this issue has just been a permanent stain on our country, going back and forth. So I think it's very timely regarding those issues as well, along with just again who we are as a nation. As you say, the three questions of nationhood: where do we come from, who are we, and where are we going? And we're trying to sort that out right now. So it's a very, very timely book.
Thank you. Yeah, that's it. It's unfortunately more, I knew it would be relevant, but it's more relevant and timely than perhaps I would like it to be.
Well, Colin Woodard, again, has been our guest today. He's the author of several books, one on pirates, if you're interested in that. That's an interesting book. But American Nations is really outstanding, and this book is as well. Again, it's called Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. Colin, thanks a lot for being our guest, and thanks for spending a little extra time with us today.
Well, thanks again for having me. Anytime.